You're listening to Psych Talk.
Dr. Alana Condor is a child clinical neuropsychologist with a background in pediatrics. She has a doctorate in clinical psychology from Baylor University, and she worked at the Medical College of Virginia, where she was a psychologist in the Department of Pediatrics. Her areas of clinical specialty include child neuropsychology, pediatric brain injury, neurodevelopmental deviations, ADHD, and learning disorders, autism, and cognitive sequelae of medical conditions, including epilepsy, diabetes, and migraine. So quite a long list. She's quite an all-purpose detective of the brain with children. We'll talk about that. She's worked for 16 years at her private practice, which is the Carolina Neuropsychological Service. That's in Raleigh, North Carolina. Dr. Condor, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, we've got so many cool things to talk about, and we were already getting excited off air to figure out where to start. But give us a sketch of the patients you've seen and maybe how they've changed over time.
Sure. In terms of age range, I work with kids as young as 2 and going up to probably 23, 24. Most of the kids I'll work with, though, are going to be 5 to 18. So young children and adolescents. And then sometimes as they're aging upward and I've been working with them before, I might follow them into college. And of course, some of the work with the youngest part of that population on the spectrum would be with their parents, doing more consultation than actual treatment of a 2 or 3 year old. Let's see, in terms of the kinds of kids that I see, probably I see more children, I would say, than adolescents, but there's a pretty much even mix. And the parents are frequently involved in the type of work that I'm doing. At this point in my practice, I work a lot evaluating children, sort of doing the detective work to find out what is going on, helping to do the diagnosis and to get services and the treatment planning more often than doing actual one-on-one treatment with all of that part of the spectrum that I see.
Hmm. You often see patients related to sports injuries. You want to mention that?
Sure. Yeah, that's becoming an increasingly frequent reason for referral. I think we've been doing an awful lot of work to try to help with the Gefeller-Waller legislation to get parents as well as student athletes and people working with them in the school system to better identify what are the warning signs and symptoms of a concussion and to take action more quickly to put steps in place to help athletes who've had a concussion. So a lot of the work that I do is with that population of students who are both youth sports, JV, and varsity athletes at the high school level who will get a concussion and trying to work out a medical plan for them to have educational interventions in the school system and to try to work very frequently to put some interventions in place very quickly, which takes a different model of input than we used to do with more traditional special ed problems. So it's been an interesting process. I think we're working very closely with the Wake County TBI, Thoracic Brain Injury team, to try to keep a system in place that meets their needs.
Great. So yeah, it looks like legislation's pushing forward different therapies and procedures, hopefully going to head to something better. Do you feel like to the extent that you're seeing more patients with concussions, it's just an awareness issue? Or that there are more concussions happening on sports fields?
Great question. I do think that it's better awareness primarily. I think if you were to go to most of the kids who come in after having some type of a hit on the field, even less than a year ago, to an emergency room, most of those would be told that if they didn't have a loss of consciousness, if they weren't throwing up, if they didn't have disconjugate gaze of their pupils, that they didn't have a concussion. And we're now trying to very systematically make sure that all the people involved, from parents to teachers, coaches, athletic trainers, are all giving the same message that there's warning signs and symptoms of concussion that are much easier to detect and much more frequent, and only a very rare, well less than 10%, are going to have a concussion that would have a loss of consciousness. So if we can detect better which people really had a concussion by defining the symptoms better, lots more kids get treated much more effectively.
Right. Well, it's great to hear that more kids are going to get the treatment they need.
Yeah.
Let's look at a bigger picture, because I want to set up a contrast between you being the child person liking to work with kids and the world of working with adults, which is what a lot of neuropsychologists do. So let's look at the adults you have worked with by way of the work you did for your doctorate, where you did have to do conventional rotations, internships.
The work that I did at Baylor would involve work with adults in outpatient and inpatient rotations that are more traditional in terms of typical therapy and intervention, diagnosis, assessment. And then I had some fairly unusual rotations when I was at the Medical College of Virginia. There was one that was consultation education, where we did some consultation to a organ transplant team trying to look at helping to assess what factors in a potential organ recipient would help to maximize the chances that having had the surgery, there would be a positive outcome. So that was very unusual, and that was lots of fun. And then working with adults having various types of depressive disorders or substance abuse. But what I found was that the rotations I liked the most were with kids, and just always was drawn to working with children. Part of what we did at one of the rotations that I did while I was still in Baylor was a residential treatment center for very disturbed adolescents and young children, and that was just fascinating to me. I always found myself pulling toward the child end of the spectrum.
Yeah, and there's so many bits there. I was fascinated by the organ donor piece, just to think that, imagining myself in that situation, like I'm about to receive an organ, I wouldn't even imagine that I'd be evaluated for my ability to adapt afterward. It just makes me think about how many different contexts a person's psychological fitness matters, and matters enough that you need a professional to come in and make that assessment.
It's fascinating. I mean, we don't think about a lot of those things, but behind the scenes, a lot of medical care integrates the psychological aspect because it helps to determine, you know, how the person will adapt to their medical illness and what we can do to make them engage in the treatment process more effectively. So it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had this work with adults and you've given us a sampling. And again, what I'm getting to is that you work mostly with children now, and that's what you've done in private practice. So I'm trying to figure out what drew you to children and maybe what some of the challenges are. And maybe adults are boring, but maybe children are over the top, so maybe they're trade-offs. But I'll just let you take the floor on this one about what makes children unique.
Sure. I've always been drawn to watching children, even long before I ever decided to go to college and study psychology or child development. I just have always watched children and found them interesting to watch how they think at different ages and how they figure things out. And I guess their developmental phenomenology. So that started early in terms of why I feel like it's interesting to work with children as a neuropsychologist. The developing brain is obviously in a state of flux and development, and so it's different at different points in time. I think that's fascinating. I think when you work with kids, there really is easy to imagine a biopsychosocial model coming alive, because you have the person and what they bring to the equation, their biology, their genetics, and their physical self. And then they have the psychosocial piece, which is not only their emotions and their personality type, but also how do they fit in their family system? What place are they in the family system? How does that play a role? And then the whole analysis of what the brain is doing at different points during development and how that plays sort of an interactive process there. It's a fun field of inquiry. And I just like kids. I work well with them. They like me. You bring a lot of energy to it and they meet you where you are. I think you work very hard. I work very differently when I work with an adult and when I work with a child. I think you have to engage in a child in a different way, especially if part of what I'm doing is an assessment. And not that many people typically think an evaluation or an assessment is going to be a fun way to spend their day. So when they come to you, you have to find a way to engage with them to make it interesting and make it so that they want to engage in the process. And I think that helping them to see that your goal is to help understand them and to make their life or something in their life better or go easier is a way to do that.
Right.
So there's fun to connect to, and it's fun to, I can see 7 different kids in a day, and very rarely am I doing the same thing twice. So there's a lot of variety. As a parent, I think the best and most important thing in my life is my kids, and I think most of the kids that I work with are that important to someone else. And if you can help them to meet a medical challenge or a neurodevelopmental crisis and make their life go better, their parents really do work with you and feel very grateful for that. It's very rewarding.
Yeah, I can imagine. Help us picture you in your office with a four-year-old or with someone who's autistic or has ADHD or has epilepsy. And are you on your knees, like wheeling in a high-pitched voice?
If you could be a fly on the wall, you'd see a lot of different things on different parts of the day. There's no requirement that we're sitting at desks most of the time. If I'm doing testing, I would prefer to be doing most of it at my desk with them in their chair. But that's a very fluid process. If kids need to move around, I'll follow them. If we're sitting on the carpet for some of it, that will not bother me as long as I know that they're engaged and looking at the materials. For most of the kids that I work with, there's sort of a system of reinforcement, if you will, for them providing good faith effort and attention to the task. So we usually have them doing something that they, every time they finished a task and we followed all the rules and done the standardized protocol for the testing, there is a minute break where they're going to pick some animal cards while we're building a zoo, or we will get connect four pieces or puzzle pieces toward making something, so that we only disrupt the process for a few seconds each time. But by the end of it, they've built enough pieces to create something or make something. Or have built a zoo, and then they get to a treasure chest. So that tends to help little kids who don't inherently want to pay tons of attention for a several-hour process to make it through. There's times where we're fooling around, and there's times where it's a little bit noisier. There's times where kids get upset, and they're under the table and refusing, or they're, you know, squeaking because they get happy. And they, when I work with autistic children and adolescents, I'm usually working real hard to get into their phenomenology, to meet with them and join with them, to try to share their humor, because they have problems with what they call reciprocity, or that back and forth social emotional exchange. So I don't ask them to meet me where I am and to want to do the task I want to have them do. I try to meet them and then bring them with me to do the task that I'm hoping that I can, you know, the evaluation or the treatment piece. So it's real interesting.
Yeah, I could see how you have to meet different children where they are, depending on their state of mind, what they're experiencing. But it seems to me, I would guess, that the treasure chest approach is pretty effective overall, the building something to look forward to and then having the toys at the very end.
The treasure chest is amazing. I mean, because it changes all the time, and it is really a treasure chest. My husband, many years ago, gave me some roses that they sent in this treasure chest that just looks like this wonderful wooden carved chest. And so I can always fill it up with prizes, and there's always something, and there's toys and there's food. I had a UNC student who, when I first worked with him, I think he was 6 years old. He's now sophomore or junior at UNC, came to see me just for a consultation about something. He says, "Do you still have the treasure chest, Dr. C?" He definitely remembered it. So I'm past the days where I've done timeout in my office recently. So, I mean, that's a long time. But there was a point at which in one of my offices, there was an area where timeout would have been done, and people would come back and they'd look in that area and have memories of being stuck in timeout, not while I was testing them, but this was when we were doing compliance training with parents to teach them how, with their very young children, to increase interaction and compliance skills. So that was a different office in a few years ago, but that was fun to see how people remember that.
Right, people hold on to certain vivid
that negative valence.
Memories.
It's very effective.
Yeah. So.
Hopefully, the treasure chest is positive valence, but.
So you're saying unless you're doing compliance training where you have sort of a defiant child, you normally don't need much negative
Never.
Reinforcement. Okay.
No, and even that, I mean, that was a number of years ago where I was working with, you know, children who are well under five. But timeout is really a lack of positive reinforcement where they have to wait and be bored, which I do think is for most children inherently an unpleasant experience. It's not directly punishing, but it's certainly not a positive situation.
Well, let's start zeroing in on the types of patients. You've told us about their ages and how there's a lot of variety. But one thing that usually gets children referred to you is that they've had some kind of brain injury. So give us some examples of how a child's brain could have a neurological problem or injury that would bring them to you, and what outcomes would be.
Sure. Children come to see me for all kinds of different types of neurodevelopmental problems. In some cases, that would be, you know, a child who has seizure disorder or epilepsy, and the neurologist feels like it would be helpful to do a workup. In some cases, the children, there's a fairly large part of the population, we can talk about this later if you want, who have had some type of birth-related event. They may have been born very premature, or they may have had a stroke at birth, or there may be directly after birth some type of an event that leads them to have either a pediatric brain injury or a stroke, And that affects their health and development going forward, and then eventually affects usually their developmental acquisition of milestones or their learning. So they'll come at some point during the developmental cycle when there is some type of difficulty meeting a challenge, either developmentally or at school, then they'll be referred. I'm not working with them right when they first determine that they have the problem. Most cases, it's when you start to see the effect of it on a somewhat older child who's either getting towards school age or is not starting to have their expressive and receptive language skills come on board, so that they're meeting a challenge that their brain condition impacts. A lot of the children who come, obviously lately, do have concussions. Some of the kids have traumatic brain injuries in the more traditional sense, where it's not a sports-related or non-sports-related concussion, but more maybe a child who has had a fall, in some cases abuse, in some cases they have been in a motor vehicle accident where they've had a brain injury, and that process of recovery is longer typically than you would see in a concussion. And it's real important to understand how that particular injury is affecting that child so that we can put accommodations in place to help them in school. Autistic kids have always been a passion. I've always liked working with kids on the autistic spectrum, so I've been doing that for many, many years. ADD students, I see lots of them, but most of the students that I see have that as more of a secondary condition. Sometimes it is a primary ADD, and there's not another associated medical or neurologic problem. Usually the traditional kids who just have a learning disability, I won't end up seeing those in my practice, but secondary learning disabilities because of other brain-related problems I will often see. There's also a little subset of people who are called have a diagnosis that it's not one of your typical diagnoses, I guess. This doesn't quite fit into some of our nomenclatures, but nonverbal learning disability. That's a population that some kids are referred because they're not clear whether that may be an issue. What a nonverbal learning disability, let's say, what would be a verbal learning disability? That's easier to start with there. That's typically someone who has problems with their expressive or receptive language or comprehension of language. The NLD children are oftentimes very good at language, but they have problems in their more visual spatial processes. So they also have a lot of difficulty orchestrating the demands of a typical day or life activity in terms of all this, the motor pieces and stepping through the social and the motor components of a day. Because they have difficulty with that, they often look awkward doing so, and they don't meet expectations in a school setting where you have to be able to make a plan, follow the plan, and have the plan turn out well. So they get referred because they seem awkward, and a lot of times they ask if those kids are autistic. Because while they're not able to do the typical challenge, they often will do some unusual behaviors that will then, somebody says, oh, well, a child does that, they're automatically probably autistic. And so sort of determining which of those two kind of disorders can be happening is part of the diagnostic dilemma. They're interesting.
I'm not that familiar with nonverbal learning disabilities, so I'm just curious if it's more of an umbrella term or if it's essentially a diagnosis.
Much more umbrella. The school system doesn't like the diagnosis because they don't have services directly geared toward it, nor do they really like the fact that a lot of times if they don't service those kids, there are problems as students. They have a lot of difficulties. So it's not a term that gets you services. You usually have to find another term that they can service and provide. It's I think, something that neuropsychologists use more often than probably some of the other disciplines. But it's interesting, not to belabor the point, I just think a lot of our daily life involves praxis, which means, you know, in layman's terms, you have a plan or an outcome you'd like, you make all the steps in the plan to have that outcome happen, and step through it, sequence it, self-correct when it's not working. And when you can't do that, life gets complicated. So even if your plan is, I just want to make my mom happy on Mother's Day by getting up and making her breakfast, there's a lot of pieces that have to go right for that to work. If the plan is to keep track of three different subjects and five different kinds of homework and long-term projects and short-term projects, there's a lot of problems with your dyspraxia getting in the way and being successful. You can make people very angry when you don't understand all the steps that go into the normal social process. So you do a lot of things wrong and you seem awkward or rude, then you're not included, then you feel sad. So it's a very interesting group of kids.
Right. And I guess it points out that just lay people going about their daily lives aren't aware of all the cognitive skills we need to deploy in order to come across as normal.
That's right. Until something's broken, you don't realize how hard it is to all the steps that were needed and all the parts of the brain and everything else to make it go right. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah, and we're seeing that a lot with robots, of course. We're saying, like, where's my robot that's going to do my homework and clean my house? Well, it's hard to artificially replicate what our brains are doing. Like, they're doing all these complex things, even just to see the world around us, right?
Oh, neat. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think about robots as much as people, but yeah. I mean, when you see how things go wrong, I guess, if you programmed one to just do one thing and then you saw how annoying it was that they perfectly did that and didn't do anything else. And we expect a lot of flexibility as humans.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, so one subset of the people you work with are autistic. And I want to look at this broader concern, a cultural concern about rates of diagnosis. Maybe there's an autism epidemic because of some pollutants in the air or something else we're eating. And or maybe it's just there are people on the complete opposite side saying, no, it's just increased awareness and a broader definition of autism. So from your vantage point and with your knowledge, what does it seem like is happening with autism diagnosis?
Well, I do think that we are certainly finding higher rates of diagnosis, and that the word epidemic is probably not accurate, but it's understandable when you start to hear about something a lot that you never heard of before or seemed rare, and now it seems like you hear about it on the media, you know, all the time. I do think the biggest piece of that, my personal belief, is that a lot of that is we have expanded the definition of what is autism. And even in the time I've been in Raleigh, in the 16 to 18 years I've been here working, we've changed the definition of what is autistic as a community. And even Teach here at UNC, which is, you know, state of the art, has changed their conception of whether people are autistic, expanding it from more traditionally autism disorder, which is the kids who have more severe and pronounced deficits, maybe lower IQ, real limited language, very restricted socially, all the way up to the autism spectrum and where you have Asperger's. And a lot of the children that I work with are currently diagnosed Asperger's. Of that population, a good number of those, when I first was here in Raleigh working just a little more than 10 years ago even, were being told that they couldn't get services at Teach and other places because they weren't autistic enough. So the more we see it as a continuum and expand the criteria, I think the more people we're going to catch. Then it would seem like that there's more people, but I don't know that there's more of the people. They're just getting more people identified as falling someplace on a continuum or a spectrum.
Right. Well, let's fixate on that definition for a moment of autism, how we almost need a word for classical autism because there's so much other autism that we didn't have before. Do you think that there's some unwanted dilution of what autism is by creating this umbrella? Maybe there were certain criteria for diagnosing autism before that were important that are now less noticed, like, I don't know, maybe physical manifestations like hand flapping. Or I've heard of criteria that don't seem to apply to all autistic people and wondered, is that just sort of gone now?
In the new system, the DSM-5, it isn't gone. It's reconfigured. And I think it is a little bit trying to capture the nuance of a continuum, of a spectrum, so that you still have the same ingredients or the requirements criteria for the definition. You still have to have the restricted patterns of interest, behavior, stereotype, narrow, that you had before. And you are still going to have a social, emotional, communication impairment. The way they have written it, I think, allows you to be at different levels of those different pieces and always be called autistic spectrum disorder. So I think it catches, in some senses, more patients adults who have different levels of variability. At the more severe end of all parts of that spectrum would still be what we would have called our classic autistic disorder kids. and probably a lot of the less severe pieces could be some of what we think of as your classic Asperger's. I think we have to figure out what we're going to do about this. I mean, every time you try to fix one problem, you create some other problems. So there's going to be, there are people concerned at everything right now with this whole DSM-5 and how it affects people on the autistic spectrum. I don't think people disagree there is an autistic spectrum, but how you want to label it and service and provide. Sometimes the people with an Asperger diagnosis don't like the idea that they're now going to be back in a group with the autistic kids who are more severe. I think the parents of the severe people are worried that they're going to lose services because it seems like a watered-down diagnosis to them, and they've worked hard to try to get very intensive services for their children who need, you know, building block by building block help. And if you include the same diagnostic piece of the puzzle being a person who's at the highest level, who a teacher might say, oh, I just need to do three different things to help them generally, versus my student who every minute I'm trying to help keep their eye contact and get them to listen, engage, and speak back to me, that's inherently going to be a problem. The school systems will have to deal with that. Insurance companies will have to deal with that. Everybody will have to figure out how they're going to let this new system work itself through.
Right. Well, there's one scenario where just the labeling changes. It's just a semantic difference, and maybe it affects the way people think, because all of a sudden two people with very different needs are both autistic. Like, that's the first label you ascribe, and maybe that's surprising and gives you some broad sense of what autism is. But then maybe there are people who would actually no longer qualify for autism, or who would be now included on the spectrum because of a shift, and that seems a little more substantive. Do you have any sense that there would be people who would stop being autistic or would start being autistic as a result of a shift, or that's sort of hard to gauge at this point?
That is hard to gauge, because their final guidelines aren't even issued yet. Yeah. In terms of what the criteria will be. Under restricted repetitive patterns of behavior, interests, and activities, you have to have two of four different criteria. So because not all four are needed, and there's going to be differences within how you'll meet the criteria, but it would allow you to meet it by having two but not all. And so one of the newer ways that they've embodied one of the four criteria for that is they call it hyper or hypo-reactivity to sensory input. That means everything from kids who are underreactive to maybe pain. So they have high pain tolerance. They are very oblivious to things going on around them in terms of noise. And hyposensitive, there's a lot of kids on the spectrum and with other disorders, but on the spectrum who are, you know, they're very sensitive to texture, or they are very sensitive to light or sound. Sometimes they put their hands over their ears. Sometimes they love move. The idea is that the body is always trying to reach some type of a balance point. So under sensitive people seek the stimulation. So the kids who are flapping and who are racing around in circles and spinning themselves around probably have an underreactive internal vestibular system, and they're seeking out the sensory stimulation. If you're hyposensitive to sound, then you might be trying to be in more quiet places and react badly to noise. So you're trying to seek out the opposite of the level of sensitivity you have. So those kids are now actively included in the diagnosis. They were just, that was sort of a peripheral thing that was not part of the criteria before. So you might see more kids who have sensory integration issues being included, as long as they have the other characteristics. But you can't get away from the fact you still need to have that deficit in something about the social communication, the emotional attachment has to be restricted and impaired. So I don't know how it all will play out.
Yeah.
It's a good question.
Huh, that's interesting. And it's fascinating, when we use the word spectrum, it's easier to think of just one dimension, like there's just one trait that gets more intense or less intense. But as we zoom into criteria, it's clear that things that are opposites can both be part of like the middle part of the spectrum. We can have oversensitivity or undersensitivity all across the spectrum, and people who are nonverbal or very verbal that are across different parts of the spectrum, right?
And even in the attention system, not the attention in terms of just an ADD type of attention issue, but if you're talking about autistic kids hyper-focus and perseverate on certain things that they are intensely interested in, and they will we'll focus on those to the exclusion of all else. But then you have a lot of other things, obviously, that are in their world that they are very under-attentive, that they're almost oblivious to. So, yeah, on a spectrum, there's a lot of different areas for you to be one pole or the other. I think most neurotypical people spend less time at the poles and more time in the middle along a lot of dimensions. And when you get to where people are either exclusively on one pole or flip-flop from one end to the other and don't spend much time hovering in the middle, is when we tend to start looking to label things, unfortunately, and diagnose things.
Right. Okay, well, we just spent a good while talking about how changing definitions of autism might work out, and there's still some uncertainty, and how it all relates to the fact that autism diagnosis is increasing, right? Now, there's a very similar sort of question about ADHD. It's not as much that there's going to be a big shift in understanding after the new statistical manual coming out soon, but there is an increase in diagnosis. People, especially mainstream media or parents, would like to say that there's some factor out in the world or in the way children are being treated that's causing the increase, and it's not just some kind of accounting difference, right? So is there any external cause of the increase, and is it all definition?
I think that's a great question. I think it's a question that we need more answers, more research to figure out. They're looking at more various environmental and, I don't know, pathogens, if you want to look at it that. But there's a lot of different things being explored. It's real important that the research be there and that the science be good, because there's just as many myths about what could be responsible probably as there are really good solid foundations to work from and explore. I think you and I were talking a little earlier during a break that there is also reason for the discussion of, are we just calling more things ADD and expanding the definition, which is certainly the case. I think everybody's looking for it now, and we expect kids to be attentive early in their lifespan. And if they're not, people get concerned, especially I think when you're in metropolitan communities and here in the research triangle where most parents have PhDs and they want their kids to be following the path of success, and if for some reason they can't do everything perfect early, someone wants to find something that's wrong to fix. So we look at things. What's fun to me, this is probably off the path, but just as a quick aside, it's fun to me to test kids' attention and to look up and see in good normative measures how inattentive you're allowed to be and be considered typical at different ages, because and also how, you know, even poor your memory can be when you're very young. When I test young children and I give them standardized tests, they can get perfectly awful scores. And you think, oh my gosh, they were terrible at this. And then you look at how many they were supposed to have correct, or how many times they were supposed to space out, or how often they were allowed to be impulsive or completely miss things. And the rates are high for kids who are young being very inattentive, very impulsive. That's not what teachers would prefer. And if they're having that problem on a daily basis in the classroom, those teachers will refer those kids. But the rate of that happening in that child may not be normatively over the top of what we consider average. Just because it's troubling to you in a classroom environment doesn't mean it's actually an impairment. Right. So it's fun to look, because at very, you know, from a 6 to 8, tremendous higher requirements of the normal, healthy, developing brain to pay attention. But under 8, all bets are off, you know.
That's fascinating, because usually the way we think of defining disorders is that sort of looking at the distribution of symptoms or severities. So there's a certain degree to which all children are impulsive and attentive. And we just say, well, here's sort of the middle, and we want to help the people on one of the edges. But you're almost saying that what people are pushing for, what teachers would prefer, what parents sometimes want in competitive or urban areas, is to pathologize what's normal because it's still not desired. So then most kids are falling within the bad range, right? And it's tough, because we could go in that direction. We could come up with a diagnosis for most people of a certain age, right, and try to treat them, put a regimen for them. But it goes against the spirit of diagnosis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's called childhood. You know, when people come in and say, you know, they're having a tantrum and they're 3 years old and I can't get through a day without going through some type of a power struggle, you say, yeah, I mean, that's very developmentally normal. It's actually even good. Here, you may want to have some management tips, but let's not put a diagnosis on it. Let's call it normal, healthy development that has some parts of it that maybe you need some tips on.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You have to remind parents that they signed up to be parents.
Right. This is good.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, where we are with the ADHD and autism, increasing rates of diagnosis, is that there are probably more headlines than there is solid research at this point, but that there's some combination of environmental factors and increasing awareness going on. Well, you have a lot of experience with schools, with insurance companies, because as you have children coming in, maybe they the parents are trying to figure out if they have a learning disability. That affects how schools think of their needs, whether they need an individualized education program or plan, depending on what country you're in, has a different name. But the IEP is an important tool that the parents can have at their disposal as a way for to get schools to think of their child as needing an extra step of attention, right?
Correct.
So let's just start with the schools. You've seen parents' stresses. Maybe you've gotten a sense of what schools are worried about and what priorities they're managing. If you were just about to wave a wand and create a perfect world, what would be your first wishes to create the perfect school-parent-neuropsychologist interaction?
Oh, gosh. That's great. It's a broad question. How big is my wand? You know?
Well, you can't change people, but maybe you can change the system.
The
like
system.
You're like a policymaker.
Yeah. You know, different types of challenges create different needs for structure. I think the concussion piece is key there because we have systems in place for kids. An IEP system is designed for a child who's going to have an identified learning disability or an identified ADD or a medical condition that presumably is going to affect them over a lot of their educational time. And there's parameters in place of how often you have to re-evaluate to make sure they still meet the conditions. But the plan is a long plan. And with concussion people, and it takes a long time to get all the people involved on the team to make the plan and a lot of pieces of paper to make that a document that's going to be stable and have all the requirements for an IEP. What we've been doing to try to change for the concussed kids who happen to have a temporary injury that may be very high in terms of its impact on academics, but very short term, and you can't wait 3 months for the team to have a meeting. So the typical thing is from when a parent or a doctor will say there's an identifying concern, you have 90 days by the school system to respond. By the time that 90 days is over, a lot of the concussed kids will also be done with their concussion if they're lucky and not need any services. So the part of the magic wand has been some of the things we're trying to work with right now that are very different, which is create a whole new model for intervention for kids who have a temporary but specific type of impairment in school. Their attention concentration system, their new learning is going to be possibly impaired after a concussion, and they need some cognitive rest opportunity, but they can't just stay home from school. So that's been very exciting. That's part of the magic wand. I hope it just keeps working because we're working here really hard in Wake County and in some of the local areas, but then we have to expand that to all of North Carolina and trying to build models across the country to handle that population. For the more typical kids, currently here in our area of North Carolina, I think we have very good services for kids who are kindergarten through fifth grade. We pull them out. We do a lot of services. And we do have some types of levels in the high school where you can go on a track toward getting more occupational training if you need it. There's a whole community of kids who are hitting middle school who need a lot more services than are available. And even though I can even say my magic wand would give us a diagnosis for each one of those, even when you have the diagnosis, in many cases, there's no system in place to help their problems. There's not the level of special education or consultation to the base teacher to help them know what to do for those kids. And they're at a critical time where you're asking all their executive systems to come on board and having them learn how to manage all of the different things being required, and there's the least support for them right now in our school systems. And then they get to high school and a lot of them don't know how to pick the pieces up and be as effective as they should be.
Right. So I guess what I'm hearing more generally is that the magic wand would be about giving a fair and proportionate amount of treatment to all groups. And there is often someone overlooked, no matter where you are. If you're not in North Carolina, you're in another state, there's still going to be some group that's not getting enough attention from administrators or the media hasn't boosted to the proper amount of care that they need.
Yeah. I have a lot more difficulty with the difference in, as a private practice neuropsychologist, how do you handle having to bill through insurance companies and their requirements and how to negotiate that with the school on their end saying this is what we need to put a system in place to help kids and the medical community or the medical insurance providers saying a lot of the those evaluations aren't covered procedures. That's currently one of the challenges you have in private practice. You might not have so much if you were in a another kind of a setting. If you worked for the school system or if you work for a state agency where their funding isn't based on getting insurance from insurance reimbursement and meeting some of those criteria of medical necessity.
So in your magic world, the insurance companies would not put so many constraints on private practices evaluations. Like you've mentioned to me that if you want to do a test of reading, that might not be covered because more of a psychological evaluation. So you would need to do that on a separate day, completely separate from a more neurological examination that might be looking at just a person's quote-unquote brain functioning or, you know, their attention.
That's right, because the integrity of the central nervous system being evaluated is considered medical necessity for, let's say, a child who has epilepsy. But what grade level they're reading at is not necessarily and sometimes is specifically denied as a covered condition, depending on the insurance company. So,
so that sort of puts you in a position where you have forced inefficiency, or you can't be quite as helpful to the family in the short amount of time as you otherwise could be if the money lined up better, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but then the insurance companies do ultimately need to make money somehow or another, so they're always going to fight.
fight, yep. Yeah. Won't go there.
Yeah. Well, just for our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Alana Condor. She's a pediatric neuropsychologist working at the Carolina Neuropsychological Service in Raleigh, North Carolina. And we have 10 minutes more of conversation. And so far, we've covered a lot of ground about autism, ADHD, the differences between working with children, who clearly are more fun than adults.
Maybe.
But also at a very sort of malleable, vulnerable time where you can see a lot of different aspects affecting the child. It can be family, it can be traumas to the brain, it can just be development as affected by genetics and environment. So there are all these factors swarming together in Dr. Alana Condor's mind as he's trying to figure out how to help a child and also still keep them engaged.
That's right.
Well, two types of patients that you work with aren't well understood in the broader public. And one of them is children with epilepsy. It seems that with the contact you have, you probably have a lot more insight into all the side effects of having epilepsy and what it's really like for a child to cope with it. So let's get into that a little more. First of all, does medication just cure epilepsy and that's it? Great.
That would be wonderful, isn't that?
Yeah.
Anticonvulsant medications are wonderful. I mean, they in the sense that the effect of having a seizure on the brain is very disruptive. So if there's a medication that will help the brain to not have seizures, and some patients have seizure disorders that could have upward of 10 to 100 seizures a day. Obviously, that's not all types of epilepsy, but there are some kids whose lives can be disrupted if it weren't for medication to a degree that few of us can imagine what it would be like to have that happen in our brain or in our child's brain. There are undeniably, it's sometimes difficult to find the right side effect to primary effect profile for the medication. So the anticonvulsants that a lot of the patients that I see who are on have positive effects in terms of keeping the brain from having a seizure, but at the same time, many of them have side effects of slowing processing speed, slowing down, sort of creating a mental fog, if you will, where kids think slower and less efficiently. I think the primary effect of having a seizure also or having subclinical seizures is that you're going to have variability of brainwave activity. And that's where I think a lot of folks aren't thinking about our kids who are students in the public school or in private schools with epilepsy, is that they may not be actually having seizures that can be seen or even absent seizures on a regular basis, but they may be having periods of abnormal brainwave activity, which are disruptive. If you think of all the things that you have to do as a student that involve working memory or new learning consolidation, where you're in a process of as a metaphor, I've picked it up, but I need to do some things with it before I get it, whether it's a long math problem or even a type of inquiry that you're learning to do when you're reading something to understand it more deeply or to understand a subject, and you have to be keeping yourself attentive and and engaged and familiar, and then it consolidates. And if there's a disruption during that period of time, the consolidation process is not very secure. So there's a lot of ways that a lot of our students who may have epilepsy would be referred by their teachers for looking to the teacher as if they have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder because they're inattentive or that's what the teachers say, they had it and they lost it, or it seemed like we had it and then it wasn't there. I think they're not paying attention. So I think that just doing a workup of the attention system and the working memory and the learning processes and figuring out where the strengths are for that student, which parts of their system are more robust, what can be used, what needs to be helped, is a very helpful process. Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah. So then the hope going forward, I guess, is to, once a child has had like a moment of absent-mindedness or confusion from, you know, sort of a micro seizure or abnormal brain activity, it's to give them the tools to pick up again, or just to mentally reframe what's happening and understand what's happening.
Right. And to have the teachers to know that if they're looking confused or if there's pauses or if they see the student isn't doing their work, to go over and regroup them. Don't say, don't you remember what we just talked about? Just repeat what was just being talked about, or remind them of what's going on. And obviously, sometimes those kids might need tutoring or something else to help them more than a teacher is able to, but it's very helpful. Yeah. And some of those students are also being given medication to help their attention system. It's not unusual for neurologists that we work with to have a student with an attention impairment that's not ADD, secondary to epilepsy, be on a medication that another student with just typical ADD might be on.
Yeah, and you had mentioned earlier that most of the children you see with ADD have some other neurological thing going on, to put it sort of bluntly. But so you might have children with epilepsy, who would they actually qualify for an ADD diagnosis sometimes, or is it almost always just attention symptoms that branch out of the epilepsy?
Some of that depends on how closely you follow the specifics of whichever DSM we're using at the time, because a lot of the current DSM-4 will say not attributable to another medical condition. So in that case, one would seem to preclude the other. So you have another set of labels and diagnoses you can use to say the attention impairment that's not ADD that would be secondary to epilepsy or premature birth. So most typically the neurologists will use those other codes. At the end of the day, sometimes the parents feel like it's easier to tell the teachers, just act like it's ADD, because you know all these strategies for ADD students, and epilepsy students scare you because you don't think you know what to do for them. So do the same thing you would do for a student with an attention deficit. And it's not because you have the diagnostic criteria. Just a lot of the medicines as well as the interventions are for attention problems, not the cause of the attention problem.
That's interesting. Okay, so let's get to this last bit that's also not very well known, just all the issues related to birth and strokes at birth. We think of strokes as mostly happening in elderly people.
Pediatric strokes happen for a number of reasons and can have a number of etiologies. But you're right. We never think of, when someone says stroke, we're thinking older person. What we're not noticing is the kids who you may have in a classroom who have right or left hemiparesis, or have some degree of weakness on one side of their body, or kids who have problems coming up with the words they need, or kids who have motor impairments, who when you go back and get their birth history, it turns out that there was a either determined or presumed stroke. And a lot of those kids just learn a little bit slower, or sometimes have perfectly normal IQ and normal functioning, but have certain areas, and oftentimes need ed plans that can be very specific to their very unique problem. But it may be a very circumscribed problem. It may just be motor output is slow and everything else is perfectly fine, but if you don't give them extended time or an alternative format instead of writing output, you know, like keyboarding, they can have a lot of difficulty depending on where their stroke is and how it affects them.
Right. And I guess usually your troubles related to birth are related to premature birth, right? And births that happen on time are a lot less likely to...
Kids who have any type of prematurity are at increased nonspecific risk for a learning or attention or developmental disorder, and not necessarily one of those three groups. And then the more premature you are, the higher the risk, not of one of those specific outcomes, but of higher risk that something will be there. So a very, very premature child would have higher risk.
Yeah.
And then there's, I mean, some strokes happen during the birth process while the parent is actually delivering the baby. There's a problem with the oxygenation, and you're going to have some sort of pediatric traumatic brain injury, but it's a neonatal problem.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, we only have time for maybe one last remark. Is there something you would say to parents of children who have, I don't know, neurological disorders or whose children seem to be acting differently? What would you say as your role as a neuropsychologist to counsel or comfort them?
I would say if you're concerned, trust your gut and try to find a specialist who you think can evaluate your child, and ask your pediatrician if there is a specialist that they would consider, especially neurology if need be, and then to go further than that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you for coming on, Dr. Condor.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.